For today's show, Kenneth Pietro Bono stopped by to talk about Florida.
This digital data flow swirling through your radio. Smash flash drastic splashic show called the Ed Sheff Radio Experiment. Sweet stuff, super sizzle, sparkle, snow, an audio beat show by Van Gogh. So slide right up and say hello to the Ed Sheff Radio Experiment.
Mess it up.
You got the hoe. Gone back in Florida. Whoa, man, keep that sack on the scales. You know the man who's paying my checks every time I will. Oh, yes, he's keeping check of the bills.
I grew up in South Miami. It's now called Cutler Bay, but at the time it was Cutler Ridge. It's in a re-imaging phase. It is now Cutler Bay. You put Miami on your address. I mean, you live in Miami. The post office knows that you live in Miami, but it's pretty much Homestead, which is where the Florida Turnpike ends, right where it dumps you off to then go to the Keys. When I was growing up, it was a predominantly lower class area, but still decent. It was working class people, but things were affordable. So everyone owned their own homes. There weren't a lot of people that were renting, but for example, the guy that lived down my best friend's father, he was a trash collector for 20 years. And, you know, their mom stayed home and we would hang out at their place. And I mean, it was kind of that, you know, like, for example, his cousin, obviously his sister's, you know, well, I don't actually know the genealogy, but anyway, they took over the custody of one of his little family members because he was born, he's a crack baby, basically. But we were horrible. We were really bad because he was a really sweet kid, but terrified of being alone. So always had to sleep in the bed with people and kind of had moments, and we would lock him in the shed. So that was, we weren't very good, but I swear it was all under someone else's influence. Was not me. Family life. It was always very odd because my mother had this feeling that she knew that she was better than where we were living, but my family, she was born in Chile, in Santiago, yeah, so, and they moved, and she was 7 years old, they moved to Connecticut, of all places, and then they got deported there, and instead of going to their deportation trial, the next day they all drove to Miami, where they lived illegally until 1996. I guess they knew that's where they could get away with it. But yeah, they moved in 72, and it took them over 20 years to get their citizenship. My house, that was when I was really young, and that that was an area called Richmond Heights and South Miami Heights, which is actually really close to, this is odd, whenever I tell people about this, it's very close to Gould's, which is where Vanilla Ice claimed to be from. He claimed that he was from the ghettos of South Miami. I think at one point he did reference Gould's, and that was his street cred. So I'm not from Gould's, but I'm close to it. But yeah, you know, typical Latin-style house. It was a 2 or 3-bedroom, and until I was about 5 years old, you know, I lived with my mom and my aunt, and we all lived in the same bedroom, and then my grandparents, and then her 3 other brothers and sisters in another room, and yeah. We had mango trees. You know, everyone's yard had mango trees, and we would sell them on Saturdays on the side of the street. And, you know, the first house I grew up in, we had an orange tree. We would get oranges from that. We had limes, and that's... I would pull them for salad that night. You know, and I mean, and looking back on it, you know, it is kind of like, whoa, I kind of did have that really kind of... It almost feels like tropical talking about it. But no, at the time, it was not at all. And I mean, we had a boat. It was like a 20-foot boat. It was a motorboat. We had a little cabin in it. Nothing glamorous. Just boat, go fishing, go, you know, hang out on the sandbars and go to regattas for the weekends and stuff like that. It was really great once we were out there, but being the only child of the family, I was always saddled with the chores of, you know, taking care of a boat is a lot. You have to get it ready to go out, and then when you bring it back, you got to make sure you wash all the salt water off of it because that erodes the fiberglass it's made of. And so, I mean, it's a lot of cleaning, it's a lot of work. So my friends loved it because they got to just, we would pick them up in the Jeep and they'd jump in and, you know, we'd go out on the boat for the day. But when we got back, it was me that was cleaning it up and doing all that. And we used to go dolphin fishing actually a lot. Mahi-mahi, the fish. Mahi-mahi is the Indian name for it, I believe. I think that's what they call it. Mahi-mahi, that's dolphin. I mean, it's the same thing. It's a big fish, not flipper. Yeah, no, it's a really great white meat fish. It's the only seafood I actually like. But it took me a while to get used to it again because we used to catch them a lot and they're huge fish. I mean, like, they're the fish that when you catch it, you have to take the hook thing and, you know, cut them in the head so they die. Yeah, otherwise they would just, I mean, a male dolphin, I think, could be up to 5 or 6 feet long. So we would catch them and take them home and skin them. And I always have to explain that it's not flipper. You know, like, relax, chill out. It's legit. But, you know, I think even I look back on it and I think, you know, that was actually a pretty cool time. You know, at the I really didn't like it then. They feed early in the morning at like 5 or 6 a.m. So you're getting on the boat at like 2 or 3 in the morning. Honestly, I don't care what you're doing or who you are, but you don't want to be cutting up squid at 5 a.m. and that's the first thing you're smelling and eating. I mean, it's not pleasant. I didn't like it at all. It was laborious.
Speaking about tornado, the hurricane, the worst of all. Some speak about tornado, the hurricane, the worst of all. They come and go through Florida, blow down 14 feet of wall. Hurricane is so powerful, blow the housing way where I live. Hurricane is so powerful, blow the housing way where I live. It may have rise on your head, give you ocean get rough. You're not in Florida all day long. Let's get together now, play a little while. If the wind don't blow me away. Lord, I really like Florida. If the wind don't blow me away. But if that don't never happen, I'll be in Florida the rest of my day.
Yeah, and I think the weirdest thing actually about Miami for me was that, so Hurricane Andrew hit in 92, and the fact that the way it looks can change so quickly, because so much of Miami is really, I don't know why, but it's perpetuated by the palm trees landscaping thing, and then when that's not around, it's just, it's incredible how barren and how sad it really is. It was my first hurricane ever, first time even getting ready for one. Looking back on it, it's embarrassing, but the truth, we were really excited for it. We were really excited for it, me and my friends down the street. I mean, school hadn't started yet also, so it was still summer, and you know, it was kind of exciting to have our parents say, hey, we have a chore for you, you need to grab all the candles and put them in this room. And I actually remember the night before it hit, me and my friend Michael, I mean, it wasn't the season, but we would spend all summer. This is just how small town, I guess, I kind of grew up. We would every weekend, we would stay at each other's houses and do the whole collect June bugs thing in a jar and then like leave them in your room overnight. So you have like a nightlight kind of a thing. And so I remember the night before that we tried to go find some so we would have light when the storm hit. But it got up to a point where it changed immediately. It became terrifying really quick. It hit in the very, very early morning. So it started hitting around, I think, like 3 in the morning, 3 a.m. And it was all over, actually, I think, by 7 or 8. It moved in really, really quick. But Cutler Ridge is very, very close to the coast. We were actually, like, 2 blocks down was the 2-mile mark of where the shore had to evacuate. So the people that lived a block or two away from us, there was nobody there. And foolishly, we stayed. And actually, it was even more terrifying because Turkey Point, the nuclear power plant, we were within 3 miles of it. It's right by a dock down by the southern end of what would be considered Biscayne Bay. And yeah, I mean, every Sunday, no, actually not every Sunday, the third Sunday of every month, we would have the test. It was just their test for if there was any kind of fallout. It's weird how quickly you become accustomed to it. You know, I think there actually, I think, was a time where when I was, you know, I was getting a little older and I was given a little more freedom to stay out a little later, that I think that my cue to come home was the siren. So we should have evacuated, but we didn't. There was hardly any plywood left. So my stepfather, in this ridiculous attempt at science, basically plotted out which windows would be the most at risk, given the rotation of the storm and how it was approaching, which is just really, really just... Yeah, so anyway, we bolted up whatever windows we could. We moved the boat to the west side of the house, since the storm was approaching from the east, and put all the cars in the carport and bunkered down. My uncle and my cousin, who were living right on the coast over there, they evacuated and stayed with us, which is kind of stupid to, you know, I mean, it's kind of like you go to higher ground, not 5 blocks away. But they came and stayed with us, and so did one of my aunts. Actually, we had a shed in our backyard, which was only like 5 feet from the house. I mean, we didn't have a huge lot or anything, but we had a shed. And my stepfather was kind of friends with anyone and everybody. I don't know how, I don't know why, but he knew some contractors that, and within a day, he was able to get them to come and dig 2-foot trenches. Basically, around the shed, there were 6 holes that were dug and filled with cement. And to dig that deep in South Florida, that takes a lot. I mean, you have one of those tractor things with a earth ripper, you know. And we filled them with cement and then put little eye loop screws through it and then took steel wire. And basically, that's how we tied the shed down, was just kind of connecting the wire from each loop to the other side and tying it down. And I'll get, once we get to the after the storm, I'll return to that. So, you know, we just got as much food as we could, and we were watching TV, I think, until 3 a.m. in the living, you know, the family room, just kind of hanging out. And I kept looking out the window. There was this one tree that was right outside the window that we had planted just a year before, so it was still a small tree. And it was about 30 degrees from the ground. I mean, it was being bent to no end. And I was fascinated by this. I was telling everybody to look at it. And I turned around, and I told everyone, they gotta come look. And by the time I turned back, it was gone. So we all decided at that point to go into the bathroom, my bathroom, which was the only room in the house that didn't have windows. I mean, South Florida house, built pre-AC, so there's windows everywhere. And my bathroom actually used to have a window, but we built an addition to the house, which was kind of blocked that we had to fill that window. So we all pile in there, and about 5 minutes later, where we were, the whole roof collapsed. And I think at that point, that's when it clearly wasn't fun anymore. It was really just, this is not fun. So we, you know, just were in the bathroom and, you know, you just hear all these windows breaking and the door vibrating. And our front door was made of, I think it was mahogany or so, I don't know, it was some kind of really dense wood. And the humidity was so high that we found this out later, but it had gotten so swollen, we couldn't open it for a month. It just swelled in the door, in the frame, and we couldn't move it. And the entire night, you just hear it humming, you know, with the wind was so strong, you could hear it just humming in the frame. And so my stepfather and my uncle decided to run out through the house, because again, they have the science that what makes your roof fly off is when there's a sudden loss of pressure in the house. So for example, if a window breaks and there's a suction, all of a sudden this pressure is sucked out of the house, and then that's what just kind of lets, if for some I don't know, that's the theory apparently. I mean, I guess it's like the top of your coffee cup, I guess, where it has a little extra spout so the air, I don't know. But they decided at one point that they were going to run around the house and take all the mattresses and throw them up against the windows. And so they went and did that. I don't know how successful they were. I don't really remember. Though the first part of the storm wasn't terribly eventful, other than the roof on that side of the house coming down and just generally being scary. It wasn't that eventful. So the eye came, and we had the eye for about 15 minutes, I think. And it was completely, completely silent. And at this point, our neighbors right next door ran over to our house and knocked because their roof had flown off and they were in the house. And so they came over, and one of them was pregnant. I mean, really, people were not prepared at all for this kind of thing. So they came in with us, and we started to go back into the bathroom, and we started smelling natural gas. And later we found out that Old Cutler, which is a street that runs right on the coast down south there, that's where a lot of gas lines run that go down to the Keys and everything, and they had all burst. So the fumes were just running through our neighborhood, and we got so sick. I mean, by this point, there's like 8 or 9 people in this one little bathroom, and you know, it was about 2 hours of just sitting in there and taking turns throwing up. And yeah, it was not cute. It was about 7 or 8 that it was gone, and we walked out of the bathroom, and I mean, every window was broken. I actually don't have anything from elementary school because it was all sucked out of my bedroom. We had somebody's bathtub in our front yard. Every tree was gone or down. I mean, you have to understand that there wasn't a storm, I think, what was it, for like 30 or 40 years. I mean, there were huge strangler figs and huge trees that, you know, went right down. I mean, it looked like a war zone. I mean, you couldn't walk anywhere. We had somebody's mail from Fort Lauderdale in my parents' bedroom. And it's really bizarre just how, you know, you look at it and you're like, how did this happen? And actually, going back to the shed, in the shed we had kept all the lawn stuff, so like a lawnmower and the weed killer and all that stuff, all the tools. So there were, the big things were all on the ground, and then other things were hanging along the shed wall. So we go out there and the shed's completely gone. The holes are empty, the cement has been ripped out, it's gone, but everything that was on the floor was untouched. So the lawnmower, the bottle of weed killer that was there, completely unfazed. Yeah, it was basically decided it was a tornado, like a small tornado that must have ripped it out. It felt like Chernobyl. I mean, it was just, I mean, you looked and it's weird to look out and the tallest thing you see is your one-story house. It's odd, you know, and especially when you grow up with, you know, I mean, you're not cognizant of it, but you grow up with, you know, there's the telephone poles and light poles and huge trees and nothing. It was just, you know, I mean, it almost felt nuclear. And of everything, the most terrifying thing was that night, because it took the National Guard, I think, about 4 days to get to us. Because, I mean, there's so many trees, so much stuff everywhere. I mean, you couldn't go anywhere. I mean, I don't care what you had. No chainsaw would deal with it. Once the National Guard came, I went to live with my grandparents for a few months because they lived by the airport, which, you know, their building wasn't really affected. But my parents stayed down there and they were without power and water for, I think, almost 2 months. And it was the reason we stayed for the whole storm period was because my stepfather was terrified of looters. And that was actually the part of the whole experience that really got to me, was that first night. It was, you know, pitch black. We're sitting in there by candles, eating Cheerios, and, you know, it's completely silent, but all you hear is the occasional breaking of glass. And, you know that they're looting your neighbor's house. And, you know, what if they come? What if they try to break into your house? And I know that night my stepfather didn't go to sleep. You know, he stood by the door with his shotgun. And that was... Well, a lot of people took the insurance money and left. Actually, that guy I was talking about with the pool across the street, he took a spray can and just spray painted the front of his house and it said Andrew was here and took the insurance money and left. The last time I was in the neighborhood, I think, was almost 5 years ago and it was still there. The abandoned house, the spray paint that said Andrew was here. Yeah, I mean, and that happened a lot. I think by now it's all really cleaned up, but, you know, people, it's hard. You really don't realize how long-lasting it really, really is. You know, I mean, there's parts of South Florida. I mean, we used to go to Larry and Penny Park, which is... Anyone in South Florida would know about it, but it's this tiny, tiny little park that has water slides. And yeah, they have water slides. They have a huge lake, and I think the lake is natural. We'll pretend it is. Clearly, the slides are not. And what anyone would remember about it is that they actually treat the water with sulfur, so it smells like rotted eggs. It was this park that was just very... very lush and so many trees. I mean, it felt like a forest. It felt like a real, real forest. And I think even now, it's still pretty barren. I mean, I think the whole thing was wiped out. Since something of that magnitude hadn't hit in so long, insurance companies didn't know how to handle it, really. And so their response was literally to just dish the money out, which is why now it's a lot harder to get the money, because they kind of saw how quickly people took it and left. I mean, I know a lot of people in the neighborhood that took the money and didn't put it towards the house or anything and just took it and moved away. Where now it's a much more difficult. That money has to be going towards the house. They're going to check your appraisers. They're going to check all that stuff. Well, the weird thing now, especially in South Florida, is the difference between homeowners insurance and flood insurance, because flood insurance isn't really involved in homeowners. And, you know, you could be robbed, but, you know, if they leave the sink on and you have flood damage, you know, I mean, they won't pay for it. I mean, it's that ridiculous. I mean, if water does anything, it's a completely separate coverage now.
Miami. South Beach, bring the heat. Can y'all feel that? Can y'all feel that? Check it out. Here I am in the place where I come let go. In Miami, the base and the sunset low. Every day like a Mardi Gras. Everybody party all day. No work, all play, okay? So we sip a little something, lay the rest to spill. Me and Charlie at the bar running up a high bill. Nothing less than ill when we dress to kill. Every time the ladies pass, they be like, can y'all feel me? All ages and races, real sweet faces. Every different nation, Spanish, Haitian, Indian, Jamaican. Black, white, Cuban, or Asian. I only came for 2 days of playing, but every time I come, I always wind up staying. This the type of town I can spend a few days in. Miami, the city that keeps the roof blazing. Get me wrong, Chi-Town got it going on. And New York is the city that we know don't sleep. And we all know that LA and Philly stay jiggy. But on the snakes, Miami bringing heat for real. Y'all don't understand. I never seen so many Dominican women with cinnamon tans. Mira, this is the plan. Take a walk on the beach, draw a heart in the sand. Give me your hand. Damn, you look sexy. Let's go to my yacht in the West Keys. Ride my jet skis, lounge under the palm trees. Cause you gotta have cheese for the summer house. Peace on South Beach. Water so clear, you can see to the bottom. $100,000 cars, everybody got them. Ain't no surprise in the club to see Sly Stallone. Miami, my second home. Miami, the city where the heat is on.
no one knows where the demarcation is, but there comes a point where you say, I am not Southern. And and so I think that's where the Miami thing comes in, is because people can't, I mean, I don't think anyone would get aggressive about it, but I don't think anyone would ever claim that they're Southern being from Miami. Southern being Dixie, but I mean, even going to Tallahassee and being, I mean, an hour north of Orlando, that can be pretty Southern. I mean, I've been to Strawberry Fields up there. What happens is that I think everyone kind of forgets that cattle is actually, it's tourism, citrus, and cattle that are the top three Florida money makers. And, you know, we all see the orange farms and everything, but I think we all forget that there's a whole lot of cattle out there. So it's, there's a lot of farm, there's a lot of those small places. My extent of Central Florida was literally the highway to Disney World. Until I am my stepfather's parents, they lived in a retirement community just outside of Tampa. and that was actually my first Walmart experience. We didn't have a Walmart in Miami until, I think it was like, it must have been like 98 or something like that. And actually, it's actually my very first time in a Walmart was when I feel so like I'm that person saying this. Was for my grandmother's funeral. We didn't plan to drive up there for a funeral, but she had been sick with cancer for a few years, and I had nothing black, so you know, we had to go buy something quick and cheap, and there was a Walmart, and that's where I got my first funeral attire, at a Walmart.
Yeah.
State, you know, you gotta rock off with the Knowles. It was odd for me. It was a last minute choice to go there. I originally was supposed to go to either NYU or BU and couldn't afford it, so I just said, all right, what state schools are still have their applications dates open? And that was one of the last ones. That the UF was already, their deadline had passed, so I think it was between UCF, which I was like cringing about, yeah, or FSU. So FSU is where I went, and I never saw it until I went up there for orientation. So it almost felt like somebody chose it for me, you know, like there was nothing pulling me to go there. It was just kind of, well, I have to wake up today and do this. It was almost like going to church, you know, I have to do it for my family. I wanted to move to New York or to Boston, and I wanted to not have a car and to, you know, be in a city, and then just to move to this, in my mind, small town. And I in high school I had never been, you know, I see all these movies about, you know, high school life, and that was not my high school experience at all. And so the same thing for me was in college. I never had the college experience. Most of the friends that I made there were from Tallahassee. They still live there. They've had children there. Yeah, it was actually the first time, you know, I had come out to my family and everything when I was about 17. So, you know, I had like a fairly open existence in Miami and was hoping to continue that in Tallahassee. And definitely at one point had beer cans thrown at me and this guy I was dating. And, part of it didn't shock me at all, but it also was a huge reminder of, you know, it's not funny anymore that I'm in this small town. I really am in this small town. And I never lived in the dorms. I always actually lived in an apartment somewhere in the city. I had almost a full-time job, so I never went home for the summers. So I practically lived there. I was there. The greatest thing was that I lived a block away from Club Publix. It was actually listed. I allegedly was listed in Playboy as the number one place to meet girls. Adapting to Tallahassee, honestly kind of came quick for me because it had to. I started working at the health clinic on campus. I mean, I worked in the pharmacy. I think the only story I carry with me now about it, I think especially since that was my first job, it made me hate the college student life so quickly because they were all such prissy jerks. I remember this one girl, you know, I mean, they're, you know, when you go to college, you're 18, 19. What do you know about your health plan? Great, you know, you're already dealing with that. But they would come across with this attitude that they don't need to know. It's not their business to know about my health coverage. And so this one girl was, I was a cashier at the pharmacy, so I had the lovely pleasure of dealing with them all the time. And she came up to me and she handed me her AvMed or whatever, you know, HMO card that she had. And so I run it through the system and it doesn't cover it. And she goes, well, I'm not going to pay for this because this should be paid for by my insurance. I said, well, actually your insurance doesn't cover it. I'm sorry, we can defer it. We can, you know, but your insurance doesn't cover it. So she whips out her cell phone and she calls her dad. And, you know, and mind you, just so you can have the image, you know, she has her little coach purse, you know. So she calls her dad, and this happens so often. She gets off the phone and she says, he wants to talk to you. And so she hands me the phone and I pick up and I say hello. And I have an earful, you know, I can't believe you don't take our insurance. What's the problem? This, that, the other. And I guess I was so fed up that I finally just, I broke and I said, sir, I'm sorry, but your insurance does not cover a pregnancy test. And handed the phone right back to her. I felt bad, but at the other end, I'm like, don't be so uppity if you're trying to hide the fact that you needed a pregnancy test. Awesome place. We used to drive down there a lot. It's the most gorgeous drive. I have not seen the world, but I would venture to say the world. The Keys really constitutes a whole lot of islands that really just kind of connect. And there's just this one, US 1 basically, just goes all the way down. And it's this one way, well, it's not one way, but it's one lane in each direction road that, I mean, there's times where the island that, you know, you're going through is so small and narrow that on each side of the road, there's only about maybe 5 feet of land and then ocean. Yeah, so I mean, you're constantly just ocean everywhere. There's not one time I haven't driven it and seen at least 5 or 6 dolphins. Real dolphins, yeah. The mammals, the ones you love. And it's incredible. I mean, and then you have a 7-mile bridge, so you're on a bridge for a long time. But I think actually driving through the islands is much more amazing. I think one time we had to leave early because there was a hurricane warning. And when that happens, it's chaos. It takes like 5 hours just to get out of there because, I mean, it's only one road. But as far as the people in the Keys, you know, I really didn't know anybody living down there, but I don't know why I've come away with this feeling that the people that live there really, really live there. Not, you know, oh, I have a summer home. And the people that live there 24/7 are either immigrants, you know, you're either, there's a big Haitian population down there, or you are an ex-convict, or you're a drunk and you're tired of your friends, you know, wanting to put you in AA or something. And so you move down there. it's this really bizarre place. I kind of wish I knew Key West a little better, because it's there's something to be said about it. The image I've taken away from it is that it's almost sad. You know, everyone else goes down there to party, but you know, for the people that live there, it's just this limbo almost. You know, you really have no ambition for tomorrow, and you really don't want to think about what happened yesterday. You know, and part of it's, you know, very laissez-faire, you know, very carefree. But again, that's something attractive to visitors, you know, to somebody living there. To me, it just comes off a little sad. Everything probably there is in tourism, and it's becoming so expensive now that the people that actually have to work there don't live there. But, you know, I mean, it's not tiny either. I mean, you know, they have an airport that's actually on the island. You know, they have banks and businesses and all that kind of stuff. I've been muckraking in the Everglades. That's basically where you hike through 3 feet of mud or deeper. The nature camp that I worked at, I used to be a camper there. And so when I did it, it was when I was a camper. So I was only like 13 years old. I mean, basically, you're in the, you know, those commercials you see of people when they're harvesting cranberries. So they're wearing, or shrimpers, you know, like you're in the suit where it's, you know, you can get wet and you put that on and you go trekking through the mud. I wouldn't say it's an adventure sport, but it's anyone that wants to actually like, maybe like bird watchers or people that are doing studies out in the Everglades. I mean, that's really the only way to get out there. And it's actually one thing I do miss is the Everglades. It feels really weird being in a part of the country that I know very little about the animals and about the plants. And, you know, because there I knew a lot. So it's very, very flat. You know, for those who don't know, it's basically the river of grass. It's about anywhere, I think, from 2 inches to 1 foot of water at all times. So it's basically, in essence, it's a huge, huge river that flows out from the aquifer under Okeechobee and just fuels this whole environment that's really unlike anything else in the world. It's absolutely huge. If you were to look at Florida from the Okeechobee Lake, I mean, I don't have a map in front of me, but basically anything south and west of it, you could consider the Everglades. Yeah, because I mean, that's actually one big problem in Miami is growth. Is you know, the whole urban sprawl is just getting ridiculous, and they keep making all of these sanctions saying, you know, we can't build any farther than Chrome Avenue, you know, but then 10 years down the road, you know, a developer wants to give the city money to build past there, and then they let them. And so it's in a weird, you know, I wish I knew more about it as far as the legal stuff going on right now. But I mean, the Everglades itself, it's really sad to me that I'm only 24 years old and I've seen the decline of the Everglades. I mean, it's really amazing to think that in 12 years or so, you know, I there's pictures. I remember there's one of my favorite birds is called a roseate spoonbill. And can I do the call? No, I wish I could. But basically, they have a pinkish tint to them, the same reason flamingos do, just because of what they eat. And their bill at the very end of it, it's a long bill, and at the end is just like a flat spoon. So they spoon things up, and that's how they eat. And they're really gorgeous. So we used to go to the Everglades during, you know, the bird season, because almost every migratory bird goes down there, and you would just, the sky would be filled with them. I mean, just hundreds and hundreds. And, you know, when I go back now, I mean, you're lucky if you see five. I've done the regular, hey, we're here from Ohio and we want to see the Everglades thing, because you can actually take a tram. There's like a paved road that goes through a small portion of the Everglades, and you can take a tram to go through it, and, you know, and you'll see stuff. I mean, you'll see deer and you'll see alligators, and mostly birds, though. I mean, birds is really the main thing. And then I've done the muckraking, where, you know, I've camped out there for five days or so, and you see owls and actually go pretty far out there. I was with 3 other people, I think. And, you know, if you sit still long enough, I mean, I had a deer that was like 2 feet away from me. Just kind of walk by, chill out, and then go on its way. It's a really cool place. I mean, you can see for miles, which is really pretty cool. And, you know, most people, you know, when you go, you want to see, you know, oh my God, I want to see Florida Panther. I want to see all this, you know, but, you know, you're not going to see anything that's that big game. And also, I mean, the Panther, I think I heard there's only like 70 left that they have a count of or something. I think there's quicksand out there, but I don't know. I know that there was a problem where I think some exotic snake had been let loose by accident and was breeding like in the Everglades. So I think that was a problem for a while. But the main thing with the Everglades right now is that it's almost entirely controlled. It's only almost entirely controlled by man, because so much of the Okeechobee and that area has been dammed and filled with canals that the water flow is completely controlled. So I mean, they practically flood, you know, in the wet season, they flood the Everglades to kind of try to regenerate it and return it to its, you know, what it was before. So there's a lot of stuff down there that's pretty screwed up about it. It's so difficult to get out there that, I mean, it's not like you're in the woods and you just walk too far and lose your way. You know, I mean, if you're going that far out there, it's because you're on, you know, an airboat, or you're in a truck, or you, I don't know if you take a helicopter in there or not, I don't know, but you have something took you there. So you really wouldn't lose yourself out there. But I'm sure there's tons of Indian folklore. The most Indian stuff I know about is like the Miccosukee Park out there and the casino, of course. I know there actually was a guy that was one of those shows that they do at the Indian reservations, and he was not eaten, but he was killed by that. You know, they put their heads in an alligator's mouth, and you know, he was killed. I have no alligator stories, other than seeing them. Where I grew up, it was just because we were in the canals. Because they're in the canals. There's a certain pattern they make when they come up to breathe. You know, especially if they're actually swimming. Because if they're just floating there, you can really easily see them. But if they're actually going and, you know, they kind of go under for a little bit, there's a pattern that their tails make. And so every once in a while when we go canoeing, we would see that. And I mean, it is scary. You know, it is scary. I think my most terrifying story, I was on our boat. We were out for mini lobster season, which is in May, I think, or April. So it's just a long weekend before the real lobster season. Where, you know, they let you go out, and our motor died, so we just kind of anchored close to this small island that was somewhere out there. And you know, we just decided, oh well, we're gonna wait for somebody to come fix it. And we had a friend that was coming, and it's actually weird. I mean, I was very, very young, but you know, pre-cell phone, woohoo! So we definitely had the radio. I don't know how to do it anymore, but at the time, I definitely knew how to do the, you know,
Walker One. This is.
Yeah, so I decided that I was going to go snorkeling and do a little tickling for lobster. And basically, you have a long, I mean, you're familiar with, you have a long, it almost feels like what you check the oil in your car with, you know, like a long dipstick kind of a thing. And you use it, and just, you go into like holes on the ocean floor, and you just tickle in there, and then the lobster comes out the other way, and you grab it. I mean, it's that almost barbaric, I guess. And, you know, I was just snorkeling, so just had a mask and fins, and that was it. And it was maybe only 20 feet deep. Wasn't anything much. And I had gone down and was coming back up, and just out of the corner of my eye, I saw this shark, and I completely did what you're not supposed to do and freaked out. I mean, screaming underwater, everything. And so I run up onto the boat, and I'm trying, you know, my snorkel in my mouth, and I'm like spewing salt water, and I'm, you know, I'm trying to scream.
Oh my God, there was a shark down there. Oh my God.
And, you know, everybody immediately started screaming for everyone to come back to the boat and all the other boats that were around. And it turns out it was just a nurse shark. So nothing to really be alarmed by. But actually that trip, I knew somebody that was bitten by a barracuda, which are actually far more aggressive and you're far more likely to be attacked by barracuda. They're attracted to things that are very shiny. So you're not supposed to wear bracelets, jewelry, nothing. But I mean, you almost can't help it, because if you're wearing a mask and it reflects, I mean, it's going to reflect naturally. So yeah, I think then we were by, so I mean, and what sucks is that I've never seen one of those. I mean, you know, you see a commercial for Caribbean Cruise Lines, and they're at a gorgeous reef, and it's colorful, and it's, you know, bounding with life and amazing. I've never seen one of those, and I've been to a lot of the reefs down there, and they don't look like that. But there are a lot of fish, and every once in a while you come across a group of them, and if you want, you can just take some food down there and, you know, like tear up some bread and carry it in your hand and then go underwater and let it go, and they'll start eating. And that was when the guy that we knew got bit by the barracuda, was because there was all these fish around him and everything. So I mean, it wasn't terrible, you know, he was bleeding, but it wasn't a gaping hole or anything. I knew somebody that got attacked by a stingray real bad. Some stingray have poison in their tail. This one did not. Basically, we were wading in by a sandbar, and so the water was just like up to our knees, maybe. And I don't know how, maybe he stepped on it, I don't know. But basically, it stung him right through the calf. And the whole thing about a stingray is that they, so if you imagine their stinger, I don't even know what you call it, being like a comb almost, but the teeth go both ways. So it can go, so it goes in easily, but then comes out with the teeth facing your flesh. So like it rips, it's not pretty. It was absolutely, it stayed with the stinger. I mean, it didn't break off.
This has been the Ed Shep Radio Experiment. Thank you for listening and tune in next week. This is Ed Shep signing off.
Beep.
You're listening to WFMU East Orange, WXHD Mount Hope, and WFMU.org.